8:03, 11:16 SEN, Melbourne's home of sport. It's half-time. Tony Shebeki filling in for Daniel Harford, who's filling in on the Drive program with Cam Moody. And they've got a big show coming up to the Wednesday Crunch with Nick Maxwell. After 4 o'clock, Greg Swan from the Brisbane Lions will join them. Also, Rebecca Wilson on Scotty Lucas after 6 o'clock. And round one, Rising Star nominee Camden McIntosh will join the boys for a chat at around about 20-7 tonight as well. So plenty to come on the run home. And then never, ever, ever forget Finey after 7 o'clock. He'll take you through until 11. The 40 Agos, 11 till midnight, wraps up your Wednesday Essential Listening right here on 11:16 SEN.
Jonathan Howcroft, Halftime's dual international. For Subway Restaurant's $5 combo deal.
And I sincerely apologise, JP, but earlier on I called you a dual national.
Well, you don't want to let people behind the wizard's curtain. You want to leave half mystic.
Exactly. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. I had a good Easter, a nice break.
Fantastic.
Rested. Now on a Wednesday.
Heaps of footy?
Not as much as I should have done. You know, that's the challenge of being married on public holidays, isn't it?
Yes.
Really enjoyed watching Hawthorn on Monday. Not a Hawthorn fan. But watching them just turn it on was an exhibition, wasn't it? And obviously Melbourne won for the first time in a decade on opening day. So happy about that as well.
Yep, and as we heard from Russell Burrock before, that decade away that they actually won their first two games, or their first three of the year. So can they repeat those feats?
I don't think it matters so much if they get the results or not, but as long as they play with the same, you know, two-way effort, I think is the key phrase, isn't it? So that they're attacking with the same intent that they're defending, and that they're advancing Paul Roos's methodology. I think that's all we want to see, and some great debuts. If the debutants can press on as well, then there's a football club to build around.
Take us. You've obviously been over in England when round one, opening round, has happened in the EPL. Is it the same sort of thing as what we've experienced here in the last few days? Just so much anticipation,
good question.
So much press heading into it.
Probably not the same level of expectation because the Premier League season is so long and the off season is so short.
Yeah.
There isn't that same time to catch your breath, and it's middle of August, early to middle of August, where there's still quite a lot of people on holiday. It still feels like summer. The cricket season's not yet finished. So
and they finish what, middle June, doesn't it? Early June.
Well, middle of May.
Yeah.
So it's
really only an 8-week, 9-week down period.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And then during that, you've got the foreign tours, the exhibition matches, like Tottenham coming here to play Sydney FC. So there isn't that same. You know, I mean, it's half a year here where you're waiting for the football again. And particularly once Christmas, New Year's passed, you can see the players training. You're kind of waiting for them.
Bit of NAB Challenge action.
Well, I think this year the NAB Challenge was just a bit underwhelming, wasn't it? We didn't get...
I was very lost with the World Cup, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And we didn't really get a sense of what was going to happen on round one. And the scheduling this year was good as well. So you knew that you were going to get a good game with Hawthorn Geelong. You knew you were going to get... Fremantle,
start and finish was going to be good. Adelaide. Richmond Carlton,
exactly, and you know, and that's got such a placeholder feel to it that I think they did a good job. And with the, you know, the fan engagement in inverted commas, it's not a very good visual for radio, that one. that there was a real sense of getting people in early and getting them. Getting them into the swing of it. So, a big take this weekend.
The other sport that I think has a massive opening day, baseball.
Yeah, and that was this weekend as well.
Yeah.
And I think this year, because this one for Ed Wyatt to text in if he's listening, because of the NCAA Final Four, they had to schedule, was it 14 or 16 teams were all playing on Sunday afternoon in one, you know, kind of consecutively one big block. So rather than it being staggered, over a period of time, most of the teams were playing at the one period. So just one massive big hit.
Yeah, exactly. Your impressions of some of the team, and I suppose one team that I'd love to get your thoughts of, are the Bombers. How do you think they went after... Well, I suppose redemption for the players earlier in the week.
Very good question. Well, this is what I want to throw out to the listeners, really. How many people watching were barracking for Sydney in that comeback?
Oh, good, yeah. But only because I tipped them.
It strikes me that the fallout from what happened... Now, clearly everything hasn't been fully resolved. We've got the potential of an Asada appeal. WADA could come over the top. Stephen Dank feels like he's floating around as a bit of a loose cannon. Who knows what direction he might take.
Be guaranteed it'll be the direction that benefits him.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Whether it benefits anybody else or not, that's the question. But it feels like we're close to resolution with this situation. But that's different from reconciliation. So there has to be a process after which a line is drawn under this affair and the world gets back on with having Essendon in an 18-team competition. Essendon fans get to re-engage with the rest of the football community. The rest of the football community re-engages with Essendon on a level that isn't tainted by what's happened over the past couple of years. And I don't know what that looks like. I'm fascinated to know what that might look like. And anybody out there that's an Essendon fan that has, you know, that can tell me what reconciliation looks like, or any non-Essendon fans that just can't get their heads around ever re-engaging with them. Let us know. Let Tony and I know. And I think as a lead-in to that, the game this weekend was a good example. That, you know, I'm guessing that there would have been a lot of neutrals barracking for Sydney this weekend because they just didn't want to see Essendon win in round one.
9429 1116. If you're an Essendon fan, even if you're not, if you've got an opinion on this, what is reconciliation? Where is it? How long does it take? Where does it come? And what does it look like for the Essendon Football Club post this Asada thing? You know, the one thing, having been to a lot of press conferences over the last couple of years, especially pre the AFL slapping of bans and fines and the like due to governance issues a couple of years ago, I always remember James Heard saying at every press conference that we were talking about in this, James Heard used to say, when this is all over, the truth will come out.
Yeah.
When this is all over, the truth will come out. Well, it's over.
Yeah.
Where's the truth?
Yeah.
Someone needs to come out and say, hey, this is what happened.
Yeah.
Because he promised us.
Yeah.
We were promised by James Heard, we were promised by the Essendon Football Club, when this is all over, the truth will come out.
Yeah, so much of this, that's a really good point. So much of this will be wrapped up in red tape. And
I don't want to be brought out in a book that I have to pay $34 for.
Yeah.
We deserve more than that. We've put up with a lot, public.
Should there be some kind of amnesty, some kind of open forum where, I don't know, what the right terminology would be, Chatham House rules or something, where people are free to say whatever they want without recourse? I mean, clearly there's the potential for too many legal implications or people coming over the top to prevent that from happening. But it seems inconceivable to me that you know, James Heard's version of the truth wouldn't have to have the rough edges smoothed off somehow. It couldn't. I mean, too much has happened.
Yeah.
You know, he couldn't come out and say, I had this conversation with Gillon McLachlan or this conversation with Andrew Demetriou and Paul Little and whatever. You know, it just couldn't happen, could it? How do we get... I mean, that's...
We'll never get the truth.
I don't think we'll get the unfiltered truth, will we? It's just what kind of truth are you happy with?
Mm.
And now that the players look like they're not going to face any further punishment, it then just becomes about how do you resolve in your own mind how the situation played out? And I can see why there'd be a lot of anger towards Asada for prosecuting the case based on the amount of evidence that the tribunal then considered. And I can see why fans would be reluctant to welcome Essendon back in the fold because of how resistant they were to the process.
Mm. Let's go to Horace out at East Melbourne, who's got his thoughts on reconciliation. G'day, Horace.
G'day, guys. You've both raised some really interesting points. I mean, the bottom line is 34 blokes were jabbed several times a week with drugs because they don't know what they were. They trusted people. And they were treated almost as lab rats or guinea pigs. And it's just unforgivable way to treat human beings. And until I think all people, including James Hurd, who was coach at the time, has gone from that club, and those 34 players are given details by Stephen Dank and others about what they were jabbed with, then there's no reconciliation with
so
that club.
The bottom line for you, Horace, is to understand what the substances were, what actually went into the players.
Absolutely. And an absolutely unmitigated apology to the 34 people concerned. And, I mean, I think Essendon have been always concerned about legal action by the 34 against them.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's an occupational health and safety investigation
yes.
against them at the moment. And we don't treat people as lab rats. It's just wrong.
I mean, one aspect of that is the question of consent, and specifically informed consent. And that was the red flag raised by the consent form that I think Job Watson talked about quite early in the piece on The Couch, wasn't it?
Where
9604 was the
he believed he may have taken.
Yes. Yeah. If the players were given all of the information available and the opportunity to challenge the process and then sign consent forms, the idea that they were, in inverted commas, lab rats isn't as big an issue for me because there was an openness to the process, presuming that the information that they were provided was accurate. And that's the problem right now, isn't it?
Nobody seems to know.
So that they signed up to a program which may have differed from, you know, what their expectations were.
Yeah, and I understand, and I'm getting hit on the SMS here, I understand the truth or nothing can be said until the appeals process is over. That's 21 days. That's fair enough. I still don't believe we're going to get anything after that.
No, me
neither. If Asada or Wada turn around and say, no, look, we'll leave it at that. It's all done and dusted. We can't go any further. I still don't believe James Hurd comes out the next day and says, all right, here's my story.
No, I'm completely with you. And then, you know, again, I'd be interested to hear what people think. How much do you think James Hurd giving a completely unfiltered view would change things?
Well, so it depends on how much people think it's an unfiltered view, how much of that unfiltered view is correct.
Yeah, and who is he talking to? Because it feels like there's a kind of a resolution amongst Essendon people, but then the rest of us, you know, the non-Essendon people.
And James Hurd could come out and tell the absolute 100% truth. Yeah. About what happened, and people will still say, no, he's lying.
And people would argue that he gave that in the press conference, you know, in the press conference on the Tuesday when the players were found that the tribunal couldn't prosecute Asada's case, that he did apologise. He did come out and say, look, you know, I wish all of this hadn't have happened, but it has, and we've got to move on.
David out of Bentley. G'day, David.
G'day, mate. How you going?
Good, buddy.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, look, I just think I am actually an Essendon supporter, and as an Essendon supporter, I've been disgusted with the governance of the club. But in saying that, the club has had the hit. They've had the biggest sanctions of all time imposed upon them, and they've taken that hit.
Yeah.
Hurd has been banned for a year. He's taken his hit. The players have gone through their time, and they've been found not guilty, or there's no evidence to show that they are guilty, so correctly, and they're not going to be suspended.
Yeah.
And then as an Essendon supporter, I've moved on. I think it's other supporters that will probably never move on, and they can like it or lump it.
Have you got, David, while we've still got you, have you got non-Essendon friends? Have you got friends who aren't Essendon supporters? We've lost David.
David.
I don't think we've got David. Be interested to know what the relationship between Essendon fans and their non-Essendon supporting fans.
Whether there were any bust-ups between friendships,
and whether they've been resolved now that the tribunal's had its say. How do you patch things up if there was an issue that broke down over the past couple of years?
Interesting. Take a break. Back with a little bit more on this, and we'll move on to other things as well. 26 past three, Jonathan Howcroft in the studio with me. A couple of final calls on this one, then we'll move on to something else. Alan at Greenvale. G'day, Alan.
Good to share, Mark.
Alan, are you there, mate?
Yep, sorry.
Buy on the share market, mate. Buy at the moment.
Yeah.
Hello. Yes, Alan, go ahead.
Yeah,
Sivak. Yes, mate.
Sivak, sorry. I just called regarding it. Sorry, my boss has just called me at the time. I'm sorry. Sivak, I'm just talking about the James Heard issue.
Yes.
Now, everyone wants to say that they didn't know what they were getting. What they know, they were told they were getting something, right? But ASADA is the one that accused them that they got something else. And now it was up to them to prove that they didn't get it. Now that it's proven that whatever ASADA was accusing them of, they weren't given. So, you know, so why do people continue to sort of, harbor any ill feeling towards Essendon when we're not guilty?
The question...
But if they choose to, because they've got an old narrative that they want to follow through, then let them go. I mean, if we are hated, we are hated. Fine, we can live with it.
The question we're asking, Alan, is how do you get reconciliation after this? And I think for a lot of people, because there's still an unknown about what actually went into the players, regardless of whether it was legal or illegal, that lack of confirmation means that reconciliation is going to be difficult.
The thing is, there's always going to be supporters out there that have hated Essendon all their life. Yep. There are going to be Hawthorn supporters out there, there's going to be Collingwood supporters, whatever, that have hated Essendon all their life. All this has done is just reinforce their belief that Essendon is a crap club. And that's been their belief for a long time, and that will stay even longer now because of what's happened.
And the process of confirmation bias throughout the whole process will only have...
Yeah, and I'm not saying that Essendon's a crap club, but that obviously the belief that is the belief of people out there.
Of course. Yeah. And the same as St. Clubs.
Exactly, as there is for Richmond, as exactly. is for Carlton, for anyone. Yeah. Barry at Boleyn, g'day, Barry.
Oh, g'day, Shebex. Look, sorry to talk like this, but I've never heard so much rubbish in all my life. Jonathan, this media spin... The bottom line is Essendon is responsible, whether it be management, coach, player, doesn't matter. The total club itself is responsible.
So based on that, Barry...
Reconciliation can never happen unless we knew what was taken. We will never find out what was taken. So this all media talk, of course, this issue will never be resolved. Because Essendon are cheats and they won't admit it. And that's the bottom line, and nobody wants to talk about it.
So Essendon will never be reconciled by the fans.
So for the remainder of the time that you follow football, you will hold this grudge against Essendon because of what's happened over the past couple of years?
Of course I will.
Did you have a grudge against them beforehand, Barry?
Not really. This two-year media Essendon hype has absolutely destroyed the game. It has brought the game into disrepute. And its commentators, we're all talking about it, but the issue is the truth will never come out. And if the truth doesn't come out, Essendon remain drug cheats for eternity until my deathbed.
A nice way to finish, Barry. No, well, it is, because I think that's going to be the majority of the feeling from a lot of non-Essendon supporters.
It's polarising, isn't it? And I think
I think maybe. Rob summed up the opposite side. Get stuff, Barry.
Yeah, I think maybe the way I thought that might go, that past 20 minutes, might be people going, all right, how do we move on? Let's move on. Do we, you know, for example, Kevin Sheedy was on Hungry for Sport this morning. He's a different, I mean, he's old Essendon, but he's also now new Essendon with this new role. So he represents a different face of the club. You've got Brendan Goddard on AFL 360. Players... That don't have the hangover from you know, from the start of this process. Can we attach ourselves to those and find a resolution somewhere further down the line?
I think Nathan in Perth sums it up beautifully. If the Bombers can get up and beat the Hawks this weekend, then I'll forgive them.
There we go.
Exactly. Hey, access to players. It seems to be becoming more and more, and even coaches as well, in the last year or two, but. Even what we saw in round one, the amount of access that TV coverage has now with coaches especially. I mean, was it Brad Scott was being interviewed coming off the field after every quarter effectively? I've never seen that happen before.
I think the point that I want to raise about this is just that how clubs don't lose in this situation. The more we're allowed access to the inner sanctum, the more they put players in front of the media. And I think, you know, mentioning Brendan Goddard on 360 is one of those examples that to try and re-engage with a club like Essendon and Jordan Lewis, who is sat opposite. I know in my football supporting friends, Jordan Lewis isn't the most well-liked opposition player from fans of non-Hawthorn, you know, fans that don't support Hawthorn. But every week you learn a bit more about them. You find out a bit more. You find out that they're smarter than you think. You find out that they're warmer than you think. That their relationships with opposition players are better than you think. And I don't think anybody loses from that. The more, and in you know, the relationship between Fox Footy and the AFL specifically is a good one. SCN is another good example. Alex Fasolo on Halftime over the past couple of years. It's been great kind of learning that players that you might not necessarily think might be your cup of tea or you only see them on the field and you think, oh, I'm not sure about that. You realise that there is a decent bloke underneath. And I think the more clubs embrace that and expose themselves to that, the better. And I think the AFL is good at doing that. Not you know, I mean, it can still get better. But from my reporting experience, one of the, you know, I do a lot of the A-League for A-League live broadcast for SEN. The contrast in dealing with some of the football clubs, for example, Melbourne City being the best, because they've got this European background where it's a much more of an arm's length relationship with the media. John Van Skip in particular is just completely resistant to any kind of encroachment on his football club. He'd build a wall around the training ground and only let the media see them for 90 minutes on a
weekend. And it's just been to their detriment.
Exactly. Exactly.
Without a doubt. Because when you get to the Melbourne Victory and you can go and see them train and then Kevin Muscat comes and he talks to you for a good 10 minutes, unfiltered, no dramas. The players are put up one or two times a week.
Exactly right.
It's not an issue.
And there's, you know, I mean, there's your basic responsibilities to your fans and your sponsors and so on, but then you can go the extra mile. And I think what we're seeing, and you know, the AFL's a good example from this weekend, that when you do that, the engagement is so much richer.
Yeah, it certainly can be, and if you want to enhance your membership, that's what it's all about. You've got to get out to your members. And if they ain't hearing from your club, then they're thinking, what the hell's happening here?
And footy in Melbourne is a competitive marketplace, and I think Melbourne City is an example, perhaps, of underestimated the challenge that they've got in overhauling Melbourne Victory.
26 minutes to 4 o'clock. Jonathan Howcroft in the studio with us. We'll be back with more of him in just a tick. Jonathan Howcroft, our dual international, joining us in the studio. And Jonathan, you mentioned earlier, you brought up the two words, fan experience or fan integration or whatever they're trying to call it. What's it like, having been our dual international, you're qualified to speak about this. How's the fan treated at an EPL game?
Much more like a consumer. And there's far less of a sense of duty or community responsibility or obligation on behalf of the Premier League clubs compared to the AFL here.
So is there a distinct difference between Premier League clubs and a Division III club?
Yes, significantly. Because the Premier League is now such a global product, they're appealing to a much bigger target audience than their local base. The idea that you would just fill Old Trafford or Anfield from, you know, people walking to the ground or getting public transport to the ground from the local communities just doesn't happen anymore. You're as likely to be sat next to somebody from Singapore or Beijing as you are from Toxteth or Ordsall, you know, in the northwest. So that sense of being a consumer rather than a member is a significant difference. So I think the idea of fan engagement here and the year of the fan and all of those kind of buzzwords were a really interesting reflection on how sport matters much more on a community level in Australia, and that the membership, you know, membership matters here. Membership to a Premier League side in the UK is just a plastic card that gives you access to different levels of services rather than actually means that you have voting rights or anything. So the idea that there would need to be a year of the fan is for a start interesting to me as a comparison.
Yeah, very much so, because I wouldn't have thought that any league around the world would actually admit that they hadn't been treating their fan well in the past. If the NBA did that over in America, there'd be lawsuits all over saying that we'd been unjustly treated for the last 5 years.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about the US, the franchise system allows them There are ongoing bargains between the municipalities and the teams and the fans and the owners and the players. You know, there's always a discussion going on. The way that the Premier League is developing is very much just a business model. So ticket prices will increase to the point that people stop paying. That hasn't happened yet to the big team, so that prices will continue to rise. And as this week, I think it was Liverpool said that they're freezing season ticket prices at current levels for next year, which is a great, you know, it feels great to me as a fan, and I hope more teams follow that same idea, that it's not just about bleeding the match-going fan of every last pound that he can.
But you can't get a ticket, can you?
Well, it is difficult, but I mean, if you just walk up, you can still get to the League Cup games or, you know, the early European qualifiers, for example. But then to do that and then see, okay, well, what's the major discussion with that football club at the moment? It's a 20-year-old player haggling over £100,000 a week contract. So there's you know, with your £50 ticket or whatever, and, you know, what else you could do with that money. That relationship is way out of whack at the moment. So to be here where it's, you know, it's still $20 to get in and your membership counts, it is a much different experience.
And the fact that we have a kick on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, that's this year. Yeah, I mean, that's.
Did you ever see the moment when the gates on the kids have a shot goal on the airfield?
No chance. I mean, just the euphoria of a once in a lifetime pitch invasion is enough to terrify people away from allowing that to happen. So, yeah, more power to footy here, and I hope that they retain that sense of community spirit and like you said, you know, off air, that idea of duty, that they're more than just it's about participation as much as being a spectator.
Yeah, very much. And I think that's why local footy thrives down here, because people have that sense of community and they don't mind going to spend 20 or 30 bucks at the bar at the local footy club because they know it's going to the local footy club.
Absolutely, yeah.
And they know their kids are probably going to go up playing for, you know, juniors through that local footy club and maybe even go on to play seniors.
Or maybe juniors in the Little League World Series.
Yes. Wouldn't that be nice? Yes, for those who may not know, my son is playing World Series baseball. It's state championships this week starting Friday. So I'm going to try and talk to Justin Huber about that tomorrow because it's big. Have you ever seen the Little League on ESPN?
It's amazing. I mean, just the concept that there's kids playing sport on TV is brilliant. So what's the route?
What happens is there's the Victorian Championship, six teams playing this weekend at Gels Park, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And if you finish in the top three, you then go on to represent Victoria in the national championships in Queensland. I think it's Queensland or Northern New South Wales, up that way somewhere.
Somewhere warmer.
Yeah. And exactly right at that time of year. And then if you win the Australian Championships being held at that Northern New South Wales place, you then go on to represent Australia. That team, amazing. So it's not a conglomerate of all the best players of all the teams.
Yeah.
That team. So for the Western Mets is who my son has been picked for. If they win, if they finish top three here, they then become the Western Mets representing Victoria and Queensland. And if they win Queensland, which is a long shot, but big long shot, then they go to Pennsylvania.
Brilliant.
And play in the World Series against teams from South Korea, North Korea, Taiwan, China, Japan, America, Canada. It's just amazing.
It will be on the new SEN promos for about all the major international sport events that are covered.
Exactly. But how cool is that?
It's amazing, absolutely
for
amazing.
For an under-12 kid to be given the opportunity to possibly represent their country in a World Series.
So how many games are the state championships?
Five.
Right.
So effectively, if they were to win three or four, you reckon they're a big chance. There's a final for first and second for the state champions and runners-up. So they go through, and then the next best of the rest.
Brilliant. Oh, well, good luck.
Yeah, well, we'll know more next week when we talk about it. Hey, let's take a break, come back and have a chat about the Masters coming up.
I worked my ass off. That's easiest way to kind of describe it. I worked hard. It was sun up to sundown. And whenever I had time, free time, the kids were asleep, I'd still be doing it. And then when they were in school, I'd still be doing it. So it was a lot of work.
Fair opening comment there from Tiger Woods about how much work he's put in to get ready for Augusta. I've worked my ass off.
Do you know, every year it feels like when the Masters comes around, it's still Tiger, isn't it? There's still a Tiger Woods narrative.
Even at 100, what is he, 121 in the world or something at the moment?
Something like that. Yeah. And you know, realistically, no chance of
wouldn't have thought
competing.
So. Not even making the cut.
Well, yeah, I mean, but just seeing him doing taking a practice round with Marco Mira, looking, you know, he looks like the old Tiger. There's the photos doing the rounds of his different spikes because he's changed his swing again. I just love it. It's great fun that it's a Masters with Tiger back in the picture. I mean, good that there's two Australians up there. I mean, Jason Day is, I think Mike Allen's been tipping Jason Day for quite a while, hasn't he, for this particular tournament. Adam Scott back to the broomstick. It's going to be a good weekend.
He's won it before, so we know the course suits him.
It's going to be a good weekend. And the have you seen the Nike trailer video that they've created to ease out? They're easing out Tiger of their promotional stuff, and they're bringing in Rory McIlroy. And they've created this video of showing actors playing Rory McIlroy from being a kid, a toddler, just picking up his first plastic golf club right through his development. Always with a TV in the background of Tiger playing different tournaments, winning different tournaments, to the final scene, which is them both on the first tee together and playing in the same competition. It's really...
Well, that's nice.
It is. It's a really nice little piece of work and just shows... And we talked with Half through the week about how Rory McIlroy is now the face of the PGA Tour console game.
Mm.
And it's another step in that transition away from Tiger back into Rory. But it feels like there's still more to go with Tiger Woods this weekend.
Do we ever think, though, that Rory McIlroy will reach the achievements of Tiger?
I personally don't. No, I think there was just something so freakish about when Tiger Woods first came on the scene. He was physically different. He trained like an athlete rather than just as what golfers used to look like. And that changed the game. When he says he works his ass off, I don't think that's ever been the problem in his decline, has it? It's been a physical issue and recently a mental issue with his chipping. So the fact that he's still working hard is just more of an indication of the standards that he set himself, that everybody else now competing on the same level with, whereas he got a head start at the start of his career, I think.
Compared to the Open, which of course is the British Open, what do you prefer to watch, the Masters or the Open?
It's a good question. There's something about the Masters that growing up, it was a specific watch. You had to watch, you know, the time was terrible to actually follow it closely. And the footage of Augusta is so beautiful.
And that's what I think it is. The fact that we know Augusta and we go back to it every year and we watch it every year at Augusta.
Yeah.
And you know what players are what trouble they're going to get into, where they're getting into trouble. You know how they're going to get out of trouble when they do get into it and all that.
Yeah.
But with the Open, because it's moving around, it's at St. Andrews, I'm not really into it.
Well, and the problem with St. Andrews, of course, is that if it's a hot, dry summer, you can win with, you know, practically 30 under.
Yes.
Because it just becomes...
Ball just keeps bouncing.
Exactly. It becomes quite an easy golf course. And then the counterpoint to that is Carnoustie. In rough conditions where the rough is 4 or 5 foot high and level par might win, and you're watching golfers effectively just hack it under the wind as much as they can, you know what you're going to get with the Masters. And apart from visually, I find the speed of the greens just incomprehensible. And I think I liked it was an interesting comment from Bubba Watson this week about how he suited to the Masters, because he considered himself the best two-putter in the game. Not that he makes that many putts from distance outright, but that he's incredibly good at two-putting. And as a consequence, that suits the greens at Augusta. So he won't lose many, many shots by three-putting. But then again, he won't make that many putts. But that's not what you have to do at Augusta. So that aspect of it, I think I struggle with, because you just can't comprehend what it's like to put on such steep, glassy surfaces.
Yeah. Speaking of Bubba, ESPN poll by players on popularity.
It's good fun, that, isn't
it? Yeah, Bubba, the least liked player.
Yeah, I think it was about 1 in 4, 1 in 5 players. I think the question was worded something like, if player X was involved in a fight outside of a bar, would you help him? Or who wouldn't you help in that situation? And Bubba Watson came out number one. Interestingly, Robert Allenby came in fourth in that poll, which puts recent events in context, I think.
Yes.
As well, doesn't it?
I think you could be wrong. And also, one in five surveys said the most expensive thing that they've bought since turning pro was an aeroplane.
How ridiculous. How ridiculous is that? I mean, talk about fan engagement and having clubs empathise with players. How can you have any empathy when a professional athlete buys a plane? I mean, you just can't, can you? It's just a different level.
Makes it hard. We'll wrap up with Jonathan in just a tick.